Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. When it floods, the first thing many of us think of is water. But in the days and weeks following the flash flood of last July in eastern Kentucky, UK researchers documented more than 1,000 landslides directly related to the flooding. A wonderfully illustrated article for The Bitter Southerner by Austin Gaffney, illustrated by Martha Park, is headlined, "Washed Away, More Flooding Linked to Climate Change Means More Landslides Across Eastern Kentucky. But without insurance, how will people pay for the damages?" It's a good question, and here to discuss it with us is Austin Gaffney. Welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you for having me.
And so you begin the piece setting the scene with a story about Linda Baker. Give us a brief nutshell about what happened to her and her family.
So Linda Baker is the mother of two kids, and she and her husband, Randy, live in the holler, a holler called Busey, just outside of Hazard. And for the second time in just over a year during the July floods, they faced a landslide. So a landslide came off the hill behind their house, hit the back of their home, and they were not able to go return to their home for over a week.
So I mentioned the UK survey of landslides in the areas of eastern Kentucky that were hit by last summer's flood. What have you learned about the damage done by landslides on an annual basis, not even accounting for that event?
So landslides are the second most common and costliest disaster in the state of Kentucky following flooding. They cost the state up to $20 million a year. That's from damage to roads, buildings, infrastructure, and it doesn't include costs like utility interruption or road closures, and also lowered property values. So I talked to our state geologist, Bill Hanberg, author of the study that you were referring to. He said we fully expect to see more extreme events due to climate change. And people who I spoke to in eastern Kentucky, residents, county judge executives, said landslides are much more common than they used to be.
You mentioned climate change, and since your article was published, climate scientists have moved up the date to sometime in the very next decade, in the 2030s, when we either have reversed warming or we go over the tipping point into an era of more constant extreme weather. Yet there is this disconnect between what the science has been and is telling us and what many people choose to believe. What are your thoughts about that?
Definitely in the state of Kentucky, with our public officials, there is a disconnect. So you'll see that in some of the candidates running for governor against our current governor, Andy Beshear. They either deny the science of climate change or believe that we don't have to address climate change as quickly as the scientists and researchers evolved in that IPCC report that was just re-released do. So with issues like landslides, where there isn't a lot of options for residents, landslides are not covered by any common homeowners insurance policy. It's a big deal because if we continue to see increasing landslides without a solution for how to handle these landslides or preparedness for future landslides, these people aren't going to be able to see a fix anytime soon.
Well, Austin, getting back to Linda Baker's experiences, what happened when she turned to her homeowner's insurance to help with the cost of fixing things that have been damaged by that landslide?
The Bakers have homeowner's insurance through State Farm, a common agency. But when they turned to their insurance agency for the first landslide in 2021, they were told it was an act of God and they were denied insurance. The same thing happened in 2022. While FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, has a national flood insurance policy, they don't cover landslides. They're included in a set of policies under earth movement, but landslides don't have a separate insurance policy like other earth movements, such as earthquakes. So basically, the Bakers were not able to get any assistance except through the Small Business Administration, which is another federal agency. That will offer low-interest disaster loans to help both businesses and homeowners recover from declared disasters. The Bakers, they were able to borrow $94,000 on their house for both landslide events, but their house is only worth $136,000. So you can see the discrepancy there.
Well, you note in the article that a problem with landslide insurance actually is a function of all insurance, that it's communal. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, so if you take the example of car insurance works because a bunch of safe drivers have to buy it and they fund the payout when unsafe drivers have a wreck. For landslide insurance to work, it would need to be sold to a lot of people who are very unlikely to see a landslide. The additional issue is that there are no building codes for infrastructure for landslides specifically, like there are for earthquakes. So there's nothing really for insurers to forecast losses against.
You mentioned that the Bakers ended up having to take out all those loans, but what happened before that? After the 2021 landslide had hit her home, they appealed to Kentucky's Abandoned Mine Lands Office and then to Congressional Representative Hal Rogers. Did they get any assistance from those quarters?
They did not. They appealed to Kentucky's Abandoned Mine Lands Division both in 2021 and 2022. They were denied both times because state hydrologists who came out said that the mine above their property, an abandoned mine about 150 yards above them, did not lead to the landslide. The team of Republican Hal Rogers from Kentucky's 5th District basically offered their sympathies via email, but did not offer them any assistance.
The Bakers' home was hit first in 2021 and then again in 2022, so 1 year after the first one. And a lot of people might give up after that and decide to move away. What about the Bakers? What did they decide to do?
The Bakers considered a relocation program. There's one available through the Small Business Administration, again, if there is a declared disaster. But Linda said it would be challenging to relocate because it's already so hard to find a house in Eastern Kentucky right now. Her husband, Randy, considered London, which is a larger town about an hour west, but they don't want to move before their son, Ian, finishes high school. He's really into band, and their daughter, Caitlin, is really into drama and the theater program in Hazard. So Linda basically told me they have too much money in it right now, that they can't sell it for what they've put into it, and they're pretty much stuck. So as long as it holds, they're going to stay, both for the financial reasons and for their kids.
So what did you learn when you talked with Magoffin County Judge Executive Matthew Wireman?
So Matthew Wireman, he said he's seen more rain in the last 7 years than he has in his lifetime. I talked to him back in December, and he was struggling to make payroll because so much of his county funds right now are going toward fixing years of landslide damage. A 2021 Kentucky Geological Survey study showed evidence of more than 1,000 landslides just in his county. So he basically told me that it's a huge burden on taxpayers in his county, and they really need extra assistance, but they also need extra assistance quickly. It takes a long time to apply for assistance to deal with landslides, and so he wanted to see that money coming from the state more quickly.
Well, on a kind of, sort of, completely different subject, Austin, I wanted to call our listeners' attention to the way that you and Martha have illustrated this story on the website of the Bitter Southerner, and we posted a link to that on our site at esweku.org. What inspired this approach? It resembles the art that we're accustomed to seeing in a comic book, for example.
Yeah, we were really lucky to work on this story, not only with Bitter Southerner, but with another magazine called Grist and a grant foundation called Economic Hardship Reporting Project. And we decided to approach this as a comic. It's our second one that we've done together because we feel like people are perhaps experiencing disaster response fatigue, both with response recovery and the future preparedness of how to deal with these disasters. And we thought an illustrated forum would help readers both connect with the story and stay with the story. Illustration can sort of bring to life a story that a reader might not typically want to sit down and read, such as the dense topic of landslide insurance. So we wanted it to be an approach that could help a reader connect better with what we think is a really important subject.
It kind of confirms that in the end, we are visual beings, aren't we? And we get, personally, I think it's a great way to tell a story.
Thank you. We both appreciate that. We think it's a helpful way to really connect a story to a reader and help them kind of stick with the story throughout.
Austin Gaffney is a freelance writer and editor based in Louisville. Her byline has appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, Grist, The Guardian, Oxford American, Rolling Stone, and Vice. Thanks so much for talking with us, Austin.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
In introducing Austin Gaffney, I mentioned University of Kentucky landslide research. Matt Crawford with the Kentucky Geological Survey led that study, and he's back to update us. When we last heard from you about landslides resulting from the flash flooding of last July, you had documented at least 1,000 that had been caused by that incredibly powerful rainstorm that stalled over the region last July. You and your colleagues earlier this year published an update on this. Can you tell us about that?
That's correct. We finally published a report that documented the landslides that were triggered by that July storm event. And this was primarily done through, you know, kind of rapid reconnaissance inspection. And about a month after the flood event, driving around the hard hit areas of the flood, taking pictures, taking notes, and documenting landslides that we were confident that were triggered by that rainfall. We did tally up over 1,000 landslides. These are everything from small sort of nuisance type of landslides that maybe come down and cover the road a little bit, or maybe even don't cover the road, to quite large and destructive debris flows, which are a particularly dangerous type of landslide. So there was a spectrum of types of landslides involved with the storm event.
Well, last year, you published a landslide risk assessment in eastern Kentucky. How do you rank those risks?
Okay, that's right. Under a FEMA hazard mitigation grant program, we have been developing landslide susceptibility and risk assessments. This started for Big Sandy Area Development District counties, which is Pike, Floyd, Martin, Johnson, McGoffin counties. Landslide susceptibility is a broad term, but it essentially revolves around different techniques to rank the likelihood of landslide occurrence. And we did that for those counties, and we used a lot of different variables and techniques to get at that answer, but it does come up with a susceptibility map that ranks the likelihood of landslide occurrence or the probability of landslide occurrence and existence on slopes. Now, it's not a predictive map because there's no time component involved. Then in addition to that, we took the susceptibility results and added things like exposure data, so roads, railroads, land value, and created a landslide risk assessment, which is very different. Theoretically or ideally, you know, if a landslide exists in the woods and no one's around or no buildings are around, it doesn't really matter, or there's nothing at risk. So adding the exposure data and asset data, consequence information to the susceptibility allowed us to generate risk maps. We are now working on that same type of project, the susceptibility and risk for Kentucky River Add District counties. So that's 8 counties. And the documentation of the landslides in the flood event, although sort of separate, will help contribute to the success of that project with the Kentucky River Add.
I would think that this formal risk assessment that you have put together here would be really important and of interest to the insurance industry.
Yes, that's a great question. Great point. Landslides are not insured under your typical homeowner's insurance policy. There's lots of reasons for that. Landslides are a local hazard or a local phenomenon. So insurance actuaries over the years have found it difficult to come up with policies because it's a localized phenomena, and there's just not the data out there to come up with policies. But we are trying to get there, right? We are trying to come up with maps and data sets that insurance actuaries could perhaps look at and come up with policies for people. And so a lot of times there's really tragic situations when a landslide impacts a home or destroys a home and families are out of luck, unless they sort of look for perhaps expensive mitigation relief.
To your knowledge, has the insurance industry indicated an interest, a need for this kind of data and information?
Yes, there has been, I think, a national effort spearheaded by some folks at the U.S. Geological Survey and others to kind of come up with landslide hazard maps for places where actually the hazard is quite low. So picture places like Kansas or Nebraska where you maybe don't get a lot of landslides because
it's kind of flat there, yeah.
It's kind of flat. But the idea is that if you start in those places and you come up with policies, people will buy them because it's just they're there and they're peace of mind and maybe it's not that expensive. And then you build out from there. Mm-hmm. But again, the challenge is, right, every state tackles landslide hazards differently. Every state has different groups of people working on this and state surveys have different funding levels and can tackle these problems differently. So we don't have the blanket hazard map like earthquakes do. Like you may have seen national earthquake hazard assessment maps that cover the whole country. We don't have that for landslides, and that's a challenge with the insurance side of it.
Are landslides for the most part natural phenomena, or do activities like logging and mining contribute?
Landslides are natural phenomenon. A landslide is sort of a blanket term for a gravity-driven downslope movement of soil and rock or some combination of soil and rock. And I always like to tell people, I heard this analogy years ago, that landslides are like flavors of ice cream. There's lots of them. And all these flavors are important to distinguish because it matters for the type of hazard involved and how dangerous the slides could be and what would potentially be at risk from these different types of slides. That said, there are contributing factors like logging or mining or any kind of slope disturbance that could enhance or contribute to the increased likelihood of slope instability.
There are efforts being made to relocate flood survivors to higher ground out of floodplains, and it's tough going to find those spots where that can make sense. One thing, building roads on those steep grades is pretty much out of the question. Does the risk of landslides complicate that search for locations?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it's a factor that needs to be considered if you're developing on hill slopes. That's not to say that it can't be done and couldn't be done safely, but you're absolutely right. It is a factor that should be addressed if there's new hill slope development. And, you know, we think some of the work we're doing here at the survey can be excellent baseline information and, you know, resources to consult when making those more site-specific kinds of decisions.
Well, we would like to catch up with you maybe again in 6 months or so and see where you are at that point.
Thank you, Tom.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Crawford. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Liz Hansen and Tom Eblin return for the final episode of our series on the rules of the road for genuine, fact-based professional journalism. In this series on the four pillars of the Society of Professional Journalists' Code of Ethics, we have focused on Pillar 1, which holds that journalists should be honest and courageous in gathering, reporting, and interpreting information. Pillar 2, on treating sources, subjects, colleagues, and members of the public as human beings deserving of respect. Pillar 3, on the imperative to act independently in meeting the highest and primary obligation of ethical journalism, and that's to serve the public. Now, Pillar 4, accountability and transparency, taking responsibility for our work and explaining our decisions to the public. Why is that important? Who would like to take that?
Often the public doesn't understand how journalists work, particularly in decision-making where the newspapers had to make a tough ethical decision. I think it's very helpful if the editor or publisher explains how that decision was reached. There's a very famous case from California in which a man who had just been convicted of murder of a child turned around to the cameras and made an obscene gesture. It was photographed, and the newspaper in that community wanted to publish that photograph. They knew it was going to be controversial, but they decided they would run it. But along with it, they ran an explanation from the editor as to why they chose to run it. And they then asked for their readers' feedback on that point. And they did not lose subscribers as a result of that. They got a lot of feedback from their community, but they made it very clear as to why they chose to run that other than to be, and it was not because they were trying to be sensational. They were trying to show the mind of this man who had just been convicted of murdering a child.
Which comes all the way back around to context, doesn't it?
Right. You know, I think editors don't explain enough in print or on the air, and I was certainly guilty of this too. I know often running controversial, particular photos tend to be because they're visual and more visceral. You know, when it came to, and I remember during the Iraq War, we published photos, say, of when the U.S. bombed Baghdad in the beginning, when some, you know, there were some other very controversial photos. And I would explain this to readers who called to complain, but we did occasionally, but probably not often enough, explain it in print to be transparent.
Do you think, can this sometimes be a casualty of capacity, so many column inches or so much time, a 10-minute segment, that kind of thing? And if you're eating up a lot of that time explaining why you did what you did, you might choose not to do that, but maybe you should.
I think that was more of a reason in the past when you know, broadcast always has a limited time frame. In print, you used to have a limited time frame. But now that really most print is really an online medium, there's kind of not an excuse for that. And one thing we've seen that I think is very helpful, the New York Times has been doing lately, is they will like run a little sidebar about their decision-making process. I've noticed that recently in several things. And I think that's a really good development because, you know, readers who have honest concerns about that, I think that helps them.
We are to respond quickly, and the word quickly is, I think, what is operative here, to questions about accuracy, clarity, or fairness. And why do you think that speed in replying is important?
Well, in terms of accuracy, the quicker you can correct a mistake, the less likely it is to get repeated over and over again. And if there is a concern with either fairness or clarity, that also needs to be addressed immediately.
And that takes us into the next point, which I think is also really, really a good one. And that is that we're human beings. We all make mistakes. Even if there's a team of us working on something, something can fall through the cracks. And that is, according to our pillars here, acknowledge mistakes and correct them promptly and prominently, explain corrections and clarifications carefully and clearly.
You know, actually, I think we see a lot more of this, and it's done a lot better now that we are mostly a digital medium instead of a hard print medium. Because, you know, when I was editing a newspaper that was primarily print, we would run a correction the next day that we were aware of in the same place every day. But now, with an online story, you can immediately fix the error. And most news organizations then, if they make a major correction of something, they will note that, you know, a previous version misspelled someone's name, or if it's a more serious issue, if it's, you know, kind of a really big screw up, then you have to have a follow-up story to explain that. But it's easier to do, and I think more effective in a digital medium.
In a print medium, the correction may never catch up with the original story also. And online, if that correction is made in the original story, then it's not going to be repeated.
We are to, and this is a collar tugger in my book. This is a real challenge. We are to expose unethical conduct in journalism, of course, but that includes within our own organizations. Now, that can be really tough. Talk about the problem of operating in a small town. Operating in a small newsroom is even closer to home. Have you experienced anything like that?
I think I'd mentioned earlier discovering plagiarism within a newspaper that my students were studying. And how do you address that? It was very difficult to point that out, even within a classroom setting, to confront the editor who was responsible. I noticed that Quill Magazine, which is the magazine of the Society of Professional Journalists, at times will run several stories about a number of ethical breaches within journalism, calling it out, basically.
Yeah, and I almost think that more of that should be done. You know, one thing I think we have to acknowledge is that journalism has changed dramatically in the last few years with online content, with cable television, and we have now many organizations that look and present themselves as journalists, but who are really not. They are entertainers or they are ideologically driven networks. I think the biggest offender of this is Fox News, which is kind of proudly right-wing, and they claim that their news and their commentary are different animals, but if you look at the way they edit their website and the way they do many news stories, that's simply not the case. I often don't think that that type of journalism is called out because they are playing to a certain audience that wants to have their views reinforced as opposed to have their views challenged. And so at a certain level, I think, you know, it's not a level playing field. You know, part of the ideological media, particularly on the right, has kind of built a niche for itself for many decades by saying you can't trust, you know, the mainstream media, you can only trust us. And so, you know, there's been this kind of, you know, 3 or 4 decade long advertising campaign against honest journalism. And I think journalists have to really be more upfront about fighting back at that, you know, and not being cowed by that type of thing. And I think part of that is by calling out bad practices.
We hold society to pretty high standards, whether it be in political elected life or civic life or private life. We hold the bar pretty high. And consequently, we're expected to abide by those same high standards. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, certainly when I was a newsroom, you know, editor, newsroom manager, occasionally, you know, staff would have to be disciplined for misconduct. And, you know, I think you deal with that fairly. If it's a published piece, you acknowledge that in print. You know, fortunately, I worked with really good people, so I didn't have that often. But I think we've seen many cases, too, of news organizations who have been pretty open about if a staff member was fired or disciplined for journalistic misbehavior. You know, there have been a few famous cases, and I think the fact that there are only a few really speaks to, I think, the ethics in journalism are pretty high when you compare it to the ethics in other major institutions, whether it be government or business or other things.
Well, our thanks to veteran journalists and former ethics professors Tom Eblen and Liz Hansen for this series examining the Code of Ethics of the Society of Professional Journalists. And again, if you'd like to take a look at that, it's on our homepage at esweku.org. Coming up after the break, high school theater in Eastern Kentucky bounces back from the flood. And Billy Joel's drummer for 30 years until one day he wasn't. Dwayne Lundy's guest, Liberty DeVito. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is Brian Burkhardt with coming events from Kentucky Humanities. On Monday, April 17th, the Mason County Public Library in Maysville will host Kentucky Chautauqua Grandpa Jones, country musician and comic. The presentation will begin at 4:30 p.m. Also on Monday, April 17th, the Woodford County Public Library is hosting a speakers bureau, the Gist Boys, Sequoia and Gratz, presented by Terry Foodie. The program will begin at 6 p.m. On Tuesday, April 18th, primetime family reading will be held at the Corbin Public Library in Corbin and the West End Empowerment Project in Lexington. Both programs begin at 5:30 p.m. For more information on programs and coming events, visit kyhumanities.org. For Kentucky Humanities, I'm Brian Burkhardt. And now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
We're back with the latest in Bill McCann's series on theater production in Kentucky.
Eastern Standard's recently concluded series, Rise, explored the effects of the July 2022 floods that devastated vast portions of eastern Kentucky. 45 people died, the property damage was tremendously high, and the challenges caused by the flood will affect families and communities for years, perhaps decades. Even now, months afterwards, some families have yet to have permanent housing. And of course, the floods damaged schools and affected the lives of both teachers and students. But like the region as a whole, schools and students, teachers and staffs are working to help their schools recover. My guest today is Phil Neese. In May 2022, after a teaching career spanning 30 years, the last 20 as drama teacher and director of theater at Perry Central High School, Phil Neese retired. But in the aftermath of the floods, Phil Neese continued in a volunteer capacity to organize the East Kentucky Dramatic Arts Society Spring Play Festival. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Phil Neese.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today.
Well, glad to have you. What is the East Kentucky Dramatic Society, ECDIS, and what is its history?
Its history came about 15 years ago. This is our 15th year for the Spring Festival. And it came about after I had started directing the theater program at Perry Central. After a couple of years after my start, we got involved in the theater festivals with the Kentucky Theater Association, which is a wonderful organization that supports theater throughout the state at all levels. And its high school festivals is something that, as we slowly got involved in it, we started figuring out how we could get a little bit more success each and every year. But it's a fall festival, and it's really the only high school festival that's truly a competition within the state of Kentucky. While we were in the midst of our season, a couple of our seniors basically got together in my advanced drama class and said, aren't there any other festivals? Because, you know, it'd be really good to do one in the, by the end of the year. We just did the KTA in the fall, but are there any other festivals in the state of Kentucky or anywhere else we could go to? And after really looking around, I said, no, there's really not. There's the International Thespian Festival, but it's also in the fall, and it's very much a good get-together for high school theaters, but the KTA is definitely more of a true competition. And I said, there's nothing really available for us to do in the spring. And that's when one of my seniors at the time, a very wise young man by the name of Wesley Cundiff, he literally, just after a second thought, said, well, can we create our own? And his light bulb over his head immediately went to mine. And very soon we started figuring out a way to create a theater festival. I asked my students, I said, all right, now, like the KTA's for the whole state. Are we going to do that? Is this going to be something we create and just do for the whole state? And they said, no, let's do this just for East Kentucky. Because at the time, there was very little representation of high school theater in East Kentucky at the KTA festivals. And we decided that we would invite drama programs that existed right then and there to come to our first ECDIS festival. Wesley was the student that actually created the name East Kentucky Dramatic Arts Society, or ECDIS. And we sent out emails just to all of the schools in East Kentucky from kind of like a border area between Ashland, Berea, and McCreary County, Whitley City, Kentucky. So that's the way it's been. And since then, it's been really a training ground for East Kentucky schools with a drama program to try and get more experience and really gain more recognition, first within their own community and then across our region. And now, with the success of it, East Kentucky is really one of the biggest regions in the entire Kentucky Theater Association high school division.
Wow. Well, given the great damage caused by the recent floods, it seems a bit surprising that high school theater programs and ECDIS in the area have continued. Why have they done so?
Yeah, we're very fortunate that there wasn't any reason why the other high school drama program said we shouldn't do it due to the flood. We had extensive damage, definitely in our central Appalachian area here in Perry County. But the most damage, really, from my own point of view and travels, was in Breathitt County, Kentucky. In fact, the area between the county line of Perry County and Breathitt County all the way into Jackson, which is about 15 miles on Highway 15, really was among the most heavily damaged areas of our region. As I was beginning to look right around December for a host school for the upcoming ECDIS Festival, before I even really started the effort in finding a place, I got contacted by two teachers from Breathitt County High School, Scott Holland and Robert Schaus, who's the art teacher and the band director, respectfully, there. They contacted me saying that they were taking over the drama program at Breathitt County, and they, knowing about the ECDIS Festival, wanted to reach out to see if they could be the host school. And they've never participated in the festival before, so they wanted to do it to build up their program and start the process of being in festivals. But I'm really glad they did, because it's going to show that the high school theater has really bounced back, as well as an example of how our entire region is trying to bounce back from the flood damage of last summer.
So besides Breathitt County High School, what other schools are involved in this year's festival?
Well, Breathitt County will be our host, and they are a newcomer to drama festivals. We're also excited that Hazard High School will be participating in its first drama festival in a very long while, in its first Ectus Festival ever. We have usual festival goers such as Lynn Camp High School in Corbin, Owsley County High School, who did a remarkable Best Newcomer Award showing at the KTA Festival last year, the state championship festival. Then we have the heavy hitters, as I like to call them, Perry County Central under their new director, Jimmy Cottle, Harlan County High School, who always brings a good quality show, and McCreary County High School. And probably the one that really has been a true success story in our mountain region, Clay County High School. Clay County in our, you know, the small town of Manchester, Kentucky, has always been known for its basketball. But let me tell you, they put on good quality high school dramas and musicals to the point that it would blow your mind how good their program is. It is bringing a lot of pride to their school and their community there in Manchester.
How does the festival work? People show up at 8 o'clock in the morning, and what happens?
As of right now, we have 8 schools performing, and we're hopeful that we could have a 9th, but right now we will have those schools performing. Other schools and the general public is simply allowed to come. We're going to start probably about 9 o'clock in the morning on April the 15th, the Saturday, giving enough time in the morning time for all of the long distance traveling schools to get there. And for the parents and supporters and anyone that's interested, there will be a $5 admission for each person to come to see the festival, but it is an all-day ticket. You can come just to see the one school that maybe you're most interested in or wanting to support, but you are definitely invited to stay the entire day to see all of the mountain schools perform. The $5 admission fee, as well as merchandise sales and concessions, are basically going to be used to fund the Breathitt County High School as the host school, and that is the opportunity that they are allowed to have as the host school for the entire festival.
I've been talking today with Phil Neese, who's helping organize this year's Ectus High School Play Festival on Saturday, April 15th at Breathitt County High School. Thank you for speaking with me today, Phil.
Thank you so much, and thanks to everybody wanting to support not just their local, but their regional high school drama programs in East Kentucky.
For Eastern Standard, this is Bill McCann.
For over 30 years, Liberty DeVito was Billy Joel's drummer, appearing on every Billy Joel tour and album from 1976 through 2006, and you're hearing him now with Paul McCartney. He's also performed with Stevie Nicks, Mick Jagger, Bruce Springsteen, Elvis Costello, and so many more rock legends. And now he appears on Eastern Standard, Dwayne Lundy's guest for our music industry interview series, Depth of Field.
One of my favorite drummers and a true rock and roll legend, Liberty DeVito. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Great. This is wonderful. I love it.
There's something really unique about your drumming. When I listen to those songs, the storyboarding of that material, and when you play, whether it's with Billy or we were just listening to your song with McCartney, it's not only identifiable you, but the way you sort of do it is not just timekeeper. You really tell a story with your drumming. Did that sort of come naturally, or was that something that you picked up over years of being in the studio?
When I was first starting to learn, my mother sent me for lessons when I was like 12. The teacher was teaching me how to play jazz, and I didn't want to learn how to play jazz. I had just seen the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show, and I wanted to do that, what Ringo was doing. So I came home, and just listening to records. I would play the records. And as I was learning, I would listen to the Beatles, like playing through the Beatles. And I noticed that, you know, I had to learn the lyrics to follow the song. So I would sing along with the song. And as I'm playing, I noticed that, you know, Ringo does a drum fill when Paul stops singing, or Ringo does a drum fill to take the band into a nicer place, like the bridge or a chorus or something like that. So lyrics became very important to me because I realized that Ringo was setting a mood because he knew what the words were and he knew what the song was about. And I took that all the way into with Billy, too. While other guys were getting the chord charts together and learning the notes and stuff like that, I would get Billy's lyrics.
One of my favorite tunes he ever played on, and one of my favorite songs, period, is Big Shot, which is a very sort of counterintuitive way to go to the hook of the song is that really deep pocket, and it sort of pulls back in there. When you were writing your drum parts, and you had the privilege of working not only with, you know, great artists, but great producers like, you know, Phil Ramone and those type of people, how much sort of going back and forth between you and the writer and the producer was there in your decision making with drumming?
Well, let's put it this way. When we the first day we would go into the studio, Billy might have two songs complete, like chords and words, maybe two. The other things were ideas that he had. And if he ran the ideas past the band and the band started to get into a feel or a groove, he would go home and continue to write the song and finish the song and come in the next day and he has a complete song because now he's got something to base the song on. My first lesson with Phil Ramone was we were doing the song Moving Out and Billy wanted it to be rum boom, da 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 dun 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 dun, that kind of thing. Phil came up to the front of the drum set and he looked at me and he goes, nope, that's not what you need to do. This is what people hear. Boom, bah, boom, bah. That's what they hear. So that was my first lesson with Phil. But all the songs that we created, like Just the Way You Are, the beat to Just the Way You Are, or like Big Shot, we created that stuff. You know that when it gets to that part, you have to be a big shot. You want it to be like, you know, you're giving the finger up, like that kind of thing.
Because you had to be a big shot, didn't you? You had to open up your mouth. You had to be a big shot, didn't you? All your friends were so knocked out. You had to have the last word last night. You know what everything's about. You had to have a white hot spotlight. You had to be a big shot.
So you played for years, obviously, before you stepped into a situation you were playing on a major label album. Then all of a sudden you're put into that scenario to where the expectation level, doing a performance in the studio, did you find that was a hard transition from playing the clubs and playing the gigs to now all of a sudden being under the microscope of somebody like Phil Ramone? Was that transition, you know, something that took a little bit of time or did you take to that pretty quickly?
No, well, the thing was that Phil came to see us play first when he was kind of offered the gig. And so when we went in the studio, the first thing that Phil said to us was, I want you to play like the rock and roll animals you are. We were very comfortable hearing that, you know. And right before that, Billy was going to use George Martin to produce what became the Stranger album. And George said, I want to use studio guys, you know, and Billy said, love me, love my band. It's like Billy knew that he wanted us to play with him. And then Phil knew that Billy wanted us. And Phil said we were a great band that came up with great arrangements for Billy's songs.
You know, the model of how writers are credited, how the royalty situation is distributed and how that sort of thing is, has been the same for years and years and years, decades. And it really undermines the session players or the band's contribution to the writing and how the end result of an album or a song comes out. Do you have an opinion? I'm sure you do, on how that could be different.
It's a shame that it is the way it is. And especially when we were doing with Billy, because we just came into the singer-songwriter time. You know, before that, there was bands like the English Invasion and all that kind of stuff. And now we're in the singer-songwriter time, and the singer-songwriter is getting signed to the label. So, you know, there's different scenarios. There's the singer-songwriter, which is great for management because they just have to deal with him. There's the band type of thing, like the Eagles, which could be a horror show because everybody signed to the label and one guy doesn't like it and it just screws everything up, you know. And so those kind of scenarios. But coming out of the singer-songwriter thing was, it was normal for guys to be considered studio guys, even though we were part of Billy's band. We were still studio guys, you know, making double scale, double session to do the sessions. But we made special deals with Billy. Like at the end of when he put the album into Columbia Records, we would get a lump of money. And every time it sold a million copies, we get a lump of money again. But those are deals that you have to make verbally. You know, you have to ask, hey, you mind if I, is it okay if I get a cut from this? You know, I did come up with that a drum beat for the song, Save the Song, Only the Good Die Young. Can I have some money? You know, they could say no, though, you know.
How much did the East Coast in being brought up where you were brought up inform, you know, your musical taste and inevitably your drumming? Because like I sort of alluded to earlier, there is such a, you know, whether it's, you know, your work with Billy or Springsteen or those type of guys, it was almost such a, like you're literally feeling like you're listening to a movie. Do you think that that's somehow related to the elements of New York and the musicals that were going there, or just happened to be an accident that sort of happened?
No, it definitely had to do with New York and the tri-state area that you're talking about. We grew up middle class, you know, blue collar middle class players, and Billy wrote songs about blue collar middle class things. You know, so we were able to relate to that. And we were just having fun. I mean, Long Island in the 60s, when I was growing up learning to play, was the place to be. I mean, Vanilla Fudge, The Illusion, The Good Rats, The Twisted Sister, all those bands, you know, were around then. So it was like they were very showy bands. Kiss, all, you know. So, you know, you tone down the look a little bit, but still continue to blow people away.
I meant to say this earlier, but you have the best rock and roll name in history. Can you give me a little background on how you ended up with the, was that, cause I know that's not your formal name. It's a shortened version of your real name. But, when did you end up with Liberty being your thing?
Well, it's my real name is Liberatore. It's Italian, you know, it means liberator of life. And, I'm named after my uncle who was killed in World War II, my father's brother. And he used to have fights because he used to call him Liberty. And the statue in the harbor of New York is a girl. So for him, it was like a girl's name. It was like he had fights all the time. But, you know, when my parents named me that, my aunts told my father, he's going to have to fight all his life because he's going to name him Liberty, you know? So when my mother was registered me in school, she registered me as Liberatore. And the teachers looked at her and said, we're going to screw that name up. What else can we call him? And she said, call him Liberty.
It's the golden era of rock. We'll never see that again. And it was, you know, such an amazing time period. And no matter what age or what type of music you're into, there is a chapter in everybody's listening that has the late 60s and the 70s part of their listening. For me, I was the Zeppelin and Stones and, you know, Elton John and Billy and what you guys were doing. When you're in that moment, did you realize what it was that was going on around you, that it was a special time?
No. When I know that the music that I listened to growing up was R&B. I loved R&B music. I loved the rock music that was coming out of England. I loved Cream. I loved Hendrix. I loved Traffic. Was one of my favorite bands ever, you know, and you could really hear the influence on the Billy albums with Stiletto, that whole yeah, he loved Traffic too. And, but no, when we went into the studio, we just thought we're just doing what we love to do. And we're just a bunch of guys who are friends forever, especially the band Topper. We were all friends, never thought about like, oh, well, this is going to be a sensation. You know, it's like, we just put a record out. This is great. Like when I wrote my book, Life, Billy, and the Pursuit of Happiness, I remember my wife said, it doesn't matter. You wrote a book. If it sells one copy, who cares? You wrote a book, you know.
And I imagine writing that book had a certain amount of therapeutic benefit to it.
It had a lot of therapeutic, because me and Billy weren't talking. You know, we didn't talk for 15 years. I started writing the book as a history, a family history for my kids, right? But then when I parted ways with Billy, I thought, let me write about my time with Billy. I put myself in Billy's shoes. And the guy has had a career for over 50 years. You have to make change. You can't stay the same. Till he finally got to the point where there was just one more thing to change, to try something different. I called him. I wrote him an email and I said, you know, I was a little disappointed at the way we ended. And he wrote me back immediately, like, so was I. And we sat and had breakfast. It was great, though, because he was talking about how the business, you know, it's not playing that's tiresome. It's the travel. And it's getting harder and harder. So he's thinking, you know, like, you know, maybe we'll wind it down a little bit. And I didn't want that gig back. You know, I'm too happy now.
2014, you go to the Long Island Hall of Fame situation. You run into Richie and Russell, play some material then, and then decide to sort of put the band together. The Lords of 52nd Street are now a relatively regularly playing band. What's that like, sort of revisiting that material with those guys?
What happened was I got the call that they were going to induct us, you know, the Billy Joel band, into the Long Island Music Hall of Fame. And I said, I'm not going. But because of Russell and Richie, I thought, okay, I'm going to go back. They asked us to play one song, but we played the one song. And then we ended up playing four or five songs, and the people loved it. So after a couple of days of being off, we talked to each other and we said, you know, so many people are making money playing what we created. We should be doing it ourselves. So it was great that we got back together again. We got a guy, you know, there's a bunch of guys that can do the Billy part. They play piano and sing. And we started to play around. And the next thing you knew, we're like all over the place now, you know.
You're asked to look back and reflect a lot. But I'd be curious as to, having done all that you've done and being as creative as you are, is there still something out there that you would want to do?
I would like to be in a band that says, and the band won the Grammy of the Year. You know, something like that, where the band is recognized.
Well, Liberty, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate it. We just absolutely adore what you've done, and your attitude towards things is just so inspiring. And it's been a real privilege, and I thank you for sharing your time.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for listening. I'm Duane Lundy. You've been listening to Depth of Field, Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director. We're online at esweku.org, and you can find us on the WEKU app, on NPR One, and Google News. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.